be with you.
And also with you.
Works like a charm.
You didn't believe it, did you?
No, I did, actually. Well, good morning, and I'm happy to see you all again. I heard rumors after our session yesterday that I had said some disturbing things, and I had no idea what they were. So I'm glad that people have come back. Let me give this caveat. I am happy to talk about anything I say. So, you know, whether we do it in a big discussion or afterwards, you know, I do preach on the weekends, and Melius and Neda are here from the Pasadena church that I sometimes work in. well,
that's a big story.
Yeah, that's a big story. There are a few of us that rotate through pulpit supply. But I usually take a historical and literary perspective to move into opening up faith ideas. So please do send your questions if you have thoughts about the methodology, or you're kind of like, wow, that's not the way I've learned it before. Please let me know. I'm happy to address those questions. This morning, we're going to dive right into Philippians. And actually, before I go there, let me make a little plug. Our church relations office at California Lutheran University asked some of the professors to create DVD lectures. And then what they were doing was giving back to the church. So this is the way that CLU supports the churches that have given to us. And then they told me that I could ask you to give a donation to our study abroad office. I take a group to Turkey every 2 years, and it changes these kids' lives, much like Holden does and has done for many of you. And it's a good chunk of money for them to put out. So if you want to give a $5, $10 donation, or if you just would like a DVD, this is Walking in the Footsteps of Paul. It's similar to my lecture yesterday, but you're welcome to have one. I don't have very many. So if you take one and you watch it and want to pass it on, please do it that way too. All right, so plug's done.
So it's a DVD or a CD?
It is a DVD. Yeah, it's video audio. I don't know if it will play in a CD player, but it will play in a movie player. So what I've done is I've broken up, Philippians is four chapters long, but I've sort of broken up our four sessions this week into four different topics. Today's topic is giving and receiving. And the book of Philippians, the letter of Philippians, I'll give you a little bit of background. It's often called the letter of joy or the letter of friendship. So if you are tired of Paul beating up on people, this is a good letter to go to. And what I found in the letter is that it encapsulates the life of community, both in the way we practice community together, that is, in what we do physically with our bodies in our relationships, and how we are to mentally be with one another, what attitudes we should have in community, and how to cultivate those. Okay, so over the 4 days, we'll be talking about the relationship between what we do and how we do it, or the attitudes that we have when we put things into practice, like serving coffee, or hospitality, or preaching and listening, or gardening, or you know, serving at Narnia. So all of these things would fit in, what we do with one another. Paul wrote Philippians around mid-career. So you figure Paul was born maybe a decade after Jesus. As I said yesterday, in the diaspora, so outside of Palestine. So probably, you know, between 10 and 15 CE, Common Era, or AD, Year of Our Lord. And we don't have any letters from him until the year 50. So we date 1 Thessalonians to the year 50. And then, as I said before, we think he perished around 64. So Philippians is placed between 65 and 63, mid-career of the letters that we do have. Now, there are letters we don't have, and we know this because they're mentioned in other letters that we do have. So Corinthians mentions a letter of tears and some other things, and scholars reconstruct this in different ways. We don't need to worry about that, but just to give you a sense. Paul writes Philippians from prison. We don't know where he is, what city he's in prison. Some say Caesarea, some say Rome, some say somewhere else. And we really can't tell. But he is in prison. And the letter is written, if you look at Philippians 1:1, right, is written from Paul and
Timothy.
Most of Paul's letters are co-written. So we tend to think about Paul as monolithic Paul, in charge of everything. No. He was always writing with some, not always, but usually his letters are written with one or two other people. Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy. Paul and Timothy. Paul and, there's another guy we think was in jail with him that he was writing with sometimes. So already we can think of Paul as operating out of a network. Okay, it would be as if one of your directors from Holden wrote a letter to someone, but of course you know that he or she is getting a lot of input from everybody else at Holden, right? It's not just that person representing themselves. It's that person representing the village in their office as director. Okay, so Paul has that sense of the co-workers around him. What then do we need to know about the church at Philippi? This was a very beloved church of Paul, hence all the friendship and the joy and the everything else. He has known the Philippians forever, seems like. They were there from the beginning of his ministry, he says, and they supported him all the way through in troubled times and in not troubled times. And in all of that exchange, right, we're going to talk about giving and receiving, so this exchange of what Paul gives and receives from the Philippians, what the Philippians give and receive from Paul, what they exchange and share in common. This is a unique church in that Paul allowed them to support him financially. He doesn't allow any other church to support him financially. And we'll talk a little bit about why. Obviously, if somebody's paying you, you have a kind of debt to them, right? It changes the relationship. So Paul is walking a very careful line with this church in terms of, yes, you sent gifts, you sent to my need, he says, and the money came with Epaphroditus. So he's very careful to talk about the financial gift that they send him in prison as part of their larger relationship, and indeed, as we'll see, an offering to God. Right? So that's the way he deflects the debt a little bit that he incurs with them, to make it a shared ministry. They also functioned as a base of missions. So if you think about Philippi is in Macedonia, all right, so it's north of Greece, to the left of Turkey. And then Thessalonica is quite close. Corinth is a little bit further down. So Philippi really served as a basis of operations, a base of operations for Paul as he was doing ministries around that area. We know three people in Philippi because Paul names them in this letter. So there is Epaphroditus. He is, some people think he may be a servant or a slave of the community, one of the owners of the house church. Others think he may just be, you know, one of the congregation who is happy to run errands for them and or who is a business person and travels a lot and carries letters. So we know about Epaphroditus. And then we know about two women, Syntyche and Euodia. Syntyche, you could think of her as lucky, right? Syntyche means with luck. Or Fortunata, I guess, would be the Roman equivalent. But Syntyche, Miss Lucky, and Euodia. And these two women seem to be leaders in the community. They're mentioned in chapter 4. And then there's a fourth person Paul refers to as my yoke fellow, the person who is linked with me in under the oxen's yoke, and we carry the mission forward. And this person, we don't know whether it's male or female. Some people conjecture that this was Paul's wife at one time or something like that. We don't know. We don't even know gender. So this person is also in Philippi. And then Timothy is, of course, with Paul. So what we get is, if we put Paul in prison, okay, and then in Philippi, we have, Epaphroditus. Syntyche and Euodia. And whoever the yoke person is. All right. We get this whole history of exchange between the two groups. Now, Paul is in prison. He can't go anywhere. And the way prisons operated in the ancient world was you were really responsible for your own food, safety, and blankets and care. They didn't supply those things for you at prisons. California is thinking about this because we have such a great debt that we're trying to think of prison reform. I don't recommend it, but anyway, that's a whole other can of worms. So what happens is Epaphroditus, let's do it this way. Epaphroditus is sent to Paul. Okay? He gets sick on the way. All right, so he has some troubles somewhere. Word gets back to the Philippians that Epaphroditus is sick, even dying. Right? Epaphroditus, meanwhile, gets better and goes to Paul and arrives there. Paul ministers to Epaphroditus, Epaphroditus ministers to Paul. Epaphroditus brings some kind of gift, probably money, maybe more blankets, something to pay for food or bribe the guards so Paul can get letters out. We don't know. And then Epaphroditus is supposed to stay and minister to Paul. But of course you have these rumors back in Philippi that Epaphroditus has been hurt along the way or is ill or maybe has died. So Paul seems very concerned to get Epaphroditus back to Philippi. And what happens is that we think this is the letter that Epaphroditus carries back to the Philippians. Okay, so if you can follow this here, so this is the little stopping point. Epaphroditus goes back with the letter. Okay. Now the next part is what will happen in the future. Let's see if I have another color. I might have another color. So what might happen in the future, or what Paul hopes will happen, is he'll find out whether he's going to stay in jail, whether he's going to get out of jail, what's going to happen to him. And he says, well, first, I will send Timothy to you to let you know how things are going with me. Okay. That's what I'm going to do in the future. And that could be a letter, that could just be Timothy comes with a note, something like that. And then Paul says, and then I'm going to come and follow you, and get to you. Now, all of this we have as a description of how Paul is operating in this one letter. And if you look, what is actually happening is an exchange of people and words, conversation between the two. So I want to include this exchange of letters and people as part of the practices of community, part of how we exercise community. And if you want to think about it on a smaller scale, I mean, here among us at Holden, we have representatives from different universities, different congregations, different denominations, different faiths, even, all coming and mingling and then taking something back out. So in a sense, you could think of this as Christian giving to Holden and then Christian receiving from Holden, okay? Or vice versa. That's what I mean by a practice, a routine of exchange of people and letters. Okay. And I'm told letters are very important here. Everybody looks forward to mail. All right, so this is one of the structures that we have going on in Philippi. Now let me talk a little bit about giving and receiving in the ancient world just in general. Okay. In brief, we could go on for hours, but in brief, the ancient system, or at least in the first century, one of my professors uses a Latin phrase to talk about this, do et das. I give so that you give, is the idea in Latin. Now that sounds like not Christmas, but obligation, but wait a minute. Don't we have an obligation sometimes at Christmas? You go to the office party, you're like, oh, I hope they don't get me a gift so I don't have to, you know, right? Or this happens in my family. One of my cousins announced that, or actually my brother last year, he said, we're not doing Christmas. So, okay. Can I still get you a gift? He's like, we're not doing Christmas. Oh. And then I thought about it and I thought, wow, that's right. If I get him a gift, then he feels like he has to get me a gift and he can't just enjoy being with the family. So, and my brother is a very subtle person, very soft-spoken person, so I have to pay attention when he actually speaks and says something. So, and honor that, right? And it makes us think a little bit about, okay, don't we feel awkward when we arrive at a lunch with an old friend we haven't seen for 6 months and they have a birthday present for us? Our birthday was a month ago, theirs was 2 months ago, and we didn't have something for them? No? Or just things like this. So the do et das, I give so that you will give, the so that in there kind of rubs. But I think we know what the ancients were trying to capture in this idea. And this is the nature, if capitalism is sort of what runs our society, and there's alternatives to that, right? But capitalism is sort of what drives our economy. In the ancient world, giving and receiving and collecting this unspoken debt and paying back the unspoken debt is what ran the society in the minds of the people. And so you can imagine that there are a number of different relationships established by giving and receiving. So for example, two friends. Let's start with two friends. Friends in the ancient world held everything in common, okay? So this is one kind of equal relationship. Now, husband and wife were not friends. That was an unequal relationship, right? So you can see why for men, male friendship was so very important because that's where they could commune with equals, okay? If you think about the Greek Senate or how things were organized politically, when people were on the same level, then it was just assumed, oh, well, your home is my home, your politics are my politics, your enemies are my enemies, your resources are my resources. You don't have that kind of equal, balanced friendship very often. But when you did, giving was simply moving assets from one part of you to another part of you. That would have been the ideal understanding. Okay. So it's like we want to think about marriage today. Two equal partners, giving and receiving goes back and forth. What's mine is yours and yours is mine. That's sort of the ideal that we have for partnering today. In the ancient times, it was with friends. So that a gift among equals would be I give something and you give the equivalent back. Now, if we're talking about an unequal relationship, for example, maybe between the emperor and a client king. Let's say between Herod and Caesar Augustus or something like that. All right, very unequal relationship. Caesar sends a gift to Herod, and Herod goes, geez, what does he want now? Right? What am I going to have to give back now? And often, because of the unequalness of the relationship, what the person, the higher status person had was money, prestige, power, land, resources, material stuff. And what the lower person had was a big voice. Okay? So this happens at our universities and our churches, I imagine, right? So the donor comes in, happens in my department. Donor comes in, says, I would like to give to you a chair in youth ministry. Oh, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with a chair in youth ministry in my religion department. But here's the money, right? And so we say, all right, let's figure this out, and then we'll put your name on the chair. I mean, the metaphorical chair, right? They're buying more than a four-footed object. The library, right? We'll give you a library. We get our name on it. All we get in return is a lot of publicity, right? The honor of being part of the university. Okay, so that's the idea. And this was how public works got done. You were a great king, Herod the Great. He had a son who was not so great, Herod. But Herod the Great was so great because he was a terror on the one hand, but he gave to building projects. He started jobs. He supplied the people with the means to feed their families through building. He added on to the temple in Jerusalem. He added on, he built in Sepphoris. He built all kinds of stadia and other things. So that was worthy of praise. So people would praise Herod. And that's what Herod was looking for, was the praise. So that's the, I give so that you will give. I give you a library so that you will talk nicely about me. And that's how that goes. All right. That's called so we have friendship of equals, and then we have patron-client. Okay, so the patron is the emperor, and the client would be the king, or you can go down the scale. Okay. Now, here's a little test for you. If I give you a particular sphere of society, and I say, all right, what is giving and receiving language in banking terms? Loans, deposits. Okay, what else?
Interest,
credit. Profit margin in the business sector, right? Okay. So if I want to talk about giving and receiving, I would talk about incurring debt or profiting you, right? If I'm giving to you, I profit you. Or if you give to me, I'm in your debt, right? Okay, how about in the sphere of politics? What is the language of giving and receiving in the sphere of politics? Money, votes, support,
earmarks,
endorsement, okay,
pork.
contributions, donations, yeah. You see how the language changes, but the concept is the same. The exchange is the same with a different language. All right, how about in the sphere of friendship then? Gift. Time.
Having coffee.
Let's have coffee. Yes.
Support.
Conversation.
Trust.
Conversation. Trust. How about my treat?
Love.
Love. Good. Oh, you guys are good at this game. Okay. Now, if we switch, how about if we go to the theological sphere or the sphere of the church? What is giving and receiving called in the church?
Tithes, stewardship.
Tithes, stewardship.
Preaching Bible studies.
Preaching Bible studies, donations I think would fit here too.
Charity.
Volunteerism, charity, grace.
Time and talents.
Gift exchange.
Time and talents, gift College. Exchange.
Offerings.
Offerings, very good, yeah.
Making coffee.
Making coffee.
Drinking coffee.
Drinking coffee. We often also use the language of sacrifice, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. You sacrifice something so that you can, or you fast and the money that you would have paid for lunch goes towards, you know, relief in another part of the country or another part of the city. Yeah. Good.
Indulgences.
On that note, let's go into scripture. Here's what I want you to do. This will give you a little bit of background for how to hear Paul. He's going to move through these different spheres of language about giving and receiving in order to guide the conversation with the Philippians of how they should think about their relationship with Paul and their relationship with Christ and with one another. Okay. So we'll see how that works. But let's start in chapter 1. And let's see. What I want you to think about, we'll read up to the prayer, so 3 through 8. What I want you to think about is what is being shared and what is being exchanged, okay? And I'll interrupt and give you little Greek tidbits here and there because they're more fun than English. Would somebody like to read? Great, thank you.
I thank my God every time I remember you, constantly praying with joy in every one of my prayers for all of you, because you are sharing in the gospel from the first day until now. I am confident of this, that the one who began a good work among you will bring it to completion by the day of Jesus Christ. It is right for me to think this way about you because you hold me in your heart. For all of you share in God's grace with me, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and the confirmation of the gospel. You want me to read 8?
Yes, please.
For God is my witness, how I long for all of you with the compassion of Christ.
Good. We'll stop there.
Oh, and this is my prayer.
No, we'll stop at 8.
We'll
yeah,
stop.
Yeah. We'll do the prayer in a second.
Yes.
All right. So, starting with verse 1, what's going on here? What is being shared?
His memory of how much he's grateful.
Good memory. Yeah. Every time I remember you, and he's sharing that memory with them. Good.
And he's telling them that I was praying for them and grateful.
So Paul is, he's giving prayer. So we'll put this under Paul. Okay, so prayer, remembrance.
Thank you.
Yeah, who is Paul thanking?
God.
Oh,
God.
Yeah,
God.
Yeah. He'll thank the Philippians later.
Yeah.
But this upsets scholars that Paul is writing, they think he's writing a thank you letter without thanking the people. I don't think he's writing a thank you letter, so I don't have that problem. Yes,
is
Tim.
Is he trying to be ethical here in some ways again? So once again, you said Philippian or Philippi is the only people giving money to him or supporting him that way.
Mm-hmm.
Is he basically saying, I still thank God, number one, he's still the person that makes or helps you make decisions, or is there, you know,
it could be this. He's less subtle in chapter 4 where we go there. So I think you'll see what you're pointing to in chapter 4. But basically, the outline of the letter, which we didn't go over yesterday, is the first thing you do is you say, from me to you all, thanks be to God. So thanksgiving is always the first part of a letter. If you go to Galatians, of course, Paul doesn't give thanks because he's really pissed. And he wants the knife to slip when they circumcise themselves. So he's very upset in Galatians. Yeah. 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 This is Paul. So So I think what we're seeing here is the formula of Thanksgiving as we go through. But let me know what you think after chapter 4. Okay.
I think he's also giving them a chance that they share the grace of God.
Where does he say grace?
Grace and peace.
No, it's seven. Right for you to think this way.
For all of you share in God's grace.
Yes.
Seven.
So it's not just kind of like he is, but he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You share in God's grace with me. Excellent. Yeah. What do we share? We share grace of God. Now, what's wonderful about the word grace, one of my favorite words, is that the word for grace, do any of you know your Greek? Charis, good. Yes, excellent. Charis. Like Eucharist, right? Different word. Charisma is, also gift. No, that's right. Charisma, charismatic is the gifts of the Spirit, yeah. So charis not only means grace, but means gift. Or in the case of Eucharist, good grace. Yeah, so all of that word play is here. So you could translate this verse. Verse 7, it is right for me to think this way about all of you because you hold me in your heart, for all of you share in God's gift with me. So already we're talking about gifts and exchange, right? Now, gift was the language of which sphere?
Friendship.
Now, what if I make a gift to the church? Also theological. Could also be political. Right? So that word gift can go across the spheres. We don't know which sphere we're in now, if we're in the political or theological or whatever. Bless you. Good. The other nice thing about the Greek in this verse is that it's very ambiguous. One of the things I love about Paul is the way he uses language. And so in verse 7, the Greek can actually be translated in two ways. It is right for me to think this way about all of you because you hold me in your heart. Or, it is right for me to think this way about all of you because I have you in my heart. So, what are they sharing? A heart. Yeah. Where we put love in the heart. That might be true back then too, but culturally, we often locate things in different places. Right? So where do we put emotions? In the heart. Now Paul's going to put them in the head. So we just have to watch that. All right, so they share a heart. And then, what else did they share?
The gospel.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Good gift here. Okay. And
they must also share some kind of imprisonment.
How do you mean?
Well, I'm not sure how I mean, but at least the text seems to talk about it that way. We are partners with me in grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense of the confirmation of the gospel.
Yes.
So there must be, I don't know whether Paul is talking about an imprisonment that has to do with, the human nature, or whether there is a sharing in some of their own trial, that he sees in them some type of struggle. It could be a metaphorical type of imprisonment.
Yeah. Prison. Yeah. But since he's in prison, we might start with the concrete physical one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And go from there. That's a wonderful observation. And I think that's very true. Now, from what I've told you about Philippians, how might Paul be letting the Philippians know that they are sharing his imprisonment? How are they sharing his imprisonment?
They're sending him blankets and gifts.
They're participating in it. They're sending a person to minister to him in prison, and they're sending gifts and blankets or money, right? Now, how do you participate in someone's baby shower or birthing? I just gave away. Through the baby shower, right? Right? How do you participate in someone's retirement? You help party. And then when they're really bored at home, you take them out sailing or something, right? Help them think about new ways to approach life or where they might volunteer. You know, walk with them through that leaving of the job. Ingrid, yeah.
We tend not, however, to do that to people who are in prison. We tend to forget them. Do we know why Paul's in prison?
No.
Is he must be really a juvenile, a delinquent, a criminal.
He was often approached as a criminal. Yeah. In ancient times, they had a different understanding of, well, Abu Ghraib is an interesting parallel here because in ancient times you could be put in prison for the charge of atheism or not supporting the people around you, not being a part of your society. So if you withdrew too much from the rest of what everybody was doing, if you didn't go with the crowd to sacrifice to Isis or throw a party for the emperor or these kinds of things. Or, as the second century writing of the Acts of Paul and Thecla has it, what Paul was preaching was abstinence, right? No sexual activity whatsoever. That if you wanted to be faithful to God, you would be a virgin. Now, how would that disrupt society? Whoa! You mean my daughter's not going to get married and have the grandchildren that I want to have? Hang her. Burn her. So this was the reaction to Paul. Now, the canonical Paul, the Paul in our Bible that has been preserved, is not preaching abstinence. He's preaching Christ. And things developed in the second century to where they had a different understanding of what Paul was doing. Or maybe that's how they developed the gospel in that area. But you can see how Paul's preaching about following Christ and Christ being central might disrupt families. And so often he was chased out of Philippi, Thessalonica, many other places for disrupting society. And that's what he would have been jailed for.
Where was the prison at?
We don't know. We don't know. There are some guesses, but we don't know.
Was Timothy in jail with him?
Timothy is mobile, so he doesn't seem to be charged with anything. There are some literary pieces that we have that show that a servant or a good friend could sleep in jail next to the person who was jailed and go back and forth because that was the only way they had care for that person. And so we have evidence that you could do that.
Do you know if they gave time-limited terms, like 2 months?
I don't. People do, but I don't have that information handy. Yeah.
Because he says he's going back to Philippi at one point.
Yes.
I wonder how he knows that.
Yeah, he doesn't know that. He's very hopeful. And part of what we know was that if you were awaiting trial, you would be either put in prison, or if you were a different level of society, you could be under house arrest. So they had different places to keep you. So an emperor would never go to prison. They would be under house arrest, or they would be exiled, or something like that. So depending on where you were in the ladder, this is what would happen to you. So I think he may have been awaiting trial and he hoped that it would turn out okay. Good, so point here that Paul is interpreting, right? Now, notice the Philippians may think they just sent him some money, but Paul interprets that sending of money and of sending a Epaphroditus, a servant, a helper, a minister, to be a participation in his situation. So even though the Philippians are way over here and Paul is way over there, they're not in the same city. We do know that. They can participate in Paul's situation through these practices of sending money. And it's a practice because they don't just do it once. They've done it a few times. Okay, good. Well, let's go. We'll skip the prayer. Let's go to what Ingrid's talking about and look at... Yeah. Will you be here tomorrow, Ingrid?
Yes.
We'll look at that tomorrow. How's that?
Yeah.
Let's look at Timothy. So chapter 2, verse 19. This is where I talk too long. Paul writes in 2:19, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon. I have no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. All of them are seeking their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But Timothy's worth, you know, how like a son with a father he has served with me in the work of the gospel. I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things will go with me. So that's where we think that he might be awaiting trial and finding out what happens to him. And I trust in the Lord that I will come soon. Now, what is being shared here?
Well, concerned with welfare.
Who's concerned for whose welfare?
Paul is concerned for Timothy's welfare.
Paul's concerned for Timothy's welfare?
Paul's
concerned for the people of Philippi. Where do you see that?
Wants to know what's happening.
I have no one like him. There's no one like him.
Sending
the
basket. Who will be genuinely concerned for
welfare? Okay. Who is genuinely concerned for the Philippians' welfare?
Timothy.
All right. So Timothy is genuinely concerned for the Philippians' welfare, and that's the reason Paul gives for sending Timothy, right? And Paul contrasts Timothy's concern for the Philippians with other folks who are concerned with what?
Themselves.
Yeah, their own interests, and not the interests of Christ. So notice that, let's do it this way. Timothy is concerned for the Philippians. He's not for himself, but for Christ. Okay? So we learn three things about Timothy. He's going to put other people first, ahead of himself. And that putting other people first, Paul interprets as a concern for Christ. Okay? So, not self-interest, but other interest is Christ's interest. Okay? All right. Now, yes, ma'am.
Is this just Paul being Paul here? Because sometimes he has sort of these literary conceits where he says, I could brag, but I won't. And I got these other people around that they aren't so good. But I'll send you Timothy. He's good. Paul likes to set up strong men and knock them down, and then finally get to his point.
Yes.
And is this sort of
yes.
What he's doing
yeah.
here with the Timothy?
Yeah. Partially. He wants the Philippians to know that the way he, Paul, makes decisions about what to share with them is according to this criterion. In other words, how do I choose whom to send? Well, I choose according to these values. Is it someone who's concerned for you or for themselves? Is it someone who's concerned for Christ? Well, if they're concerned for you, that's a concern for Christ. That's what... And by explaining this to the Philippians, what is he doing?
He's showing his concern.
He's showing his concern. So it's not just Timothy who's putting other people first. It's Paul. Because he's choosing someone who puts them first. Right? Not someone who's going to boast and praise Paul.
He also knows that there are people that won't do that.
Yes. And, oh, go ahead.
But who are those other people?
We don't know.
They're obviously hanging around him, and they have some connection with him.
We don't know. And it may not matter. They may be a straw man in the argument. Okay? But the other thing that Paul is doing is he's teaching them. Right? If I explain to you how I'm doing something, why would I explain that to you? So that you can have that understanding, and maybe you will do things that way too. Okay? So Paul says, look, this is the criterion for choosing whom to send to you. I'm putting you first, which is putting Christ first. He puts you first, which puts Christ first. Guess what he's going to tell the Philippians to do? Stop being in your own interest and start paying attention to other people. Okay? Right? All that from four verses. Right? This is what he's teaching them. And how do I know? Because he does it over and over and over and over. Let's look at the next part.
He's also ensuring that Timothy's going to be really well
received. Yes, exactly. Yes. So if I tell you how great a gift I'm giving you, you will welcome that gift with open arms. And maybe later you'll find out it has some quirks too, but, right? So it's partially a letter of recommendation for Timothy to assure this welcome. Yes?
Is Paul trying to set up support for itinerancy and also maybe have more of a global vision as opposed to a local vision of like what it means to support church? Is he pushing that underneath everything?
He does in 2 Corinthians, where we'll go next week, but I think here he's more concerned about the relationships between himself and the Philippians and how to do community locally. Yeah. Because he doesn't really, except as straw figures, bring in other folks.
So straw doesn't necessarily mean you take care of your own community.
I'm sorry?
To be concerned with your own interest doesn't just mean to be taking care of your local community. He's not chastising people for taking care of their local communities.
No, I think that's what he wants them to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. To take care of each other. Yeah. All right, so let's look at the next part. So he goes immediately from Timothy, who he's going to send, to Epaphroditus. I trust in the Lord that I will come soon. Now, verse 25 of chapter 2. Still, I think it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and co-worker and fellow soldier, your messenger, your minister to my need. Now, that's a list of recommendations. This is the longest list of adjectives that he attaches to any of the people that he's recommending. Okay. So people make a lot of this. You know, what is he trying to defend Epaphroditus from, blah, blah, blah. But notice the different spheres here. Brother, so there's family. Co-worker, so there's ministry or business. Fellow soldier, there's a military. And your messenger, he's recognizing that the Philippians sent Epaphroditus to him first. So your apostle, your representative, and minister to my need. Pastoring. Epaphroditus is ministering, is pastoring. Okay. For Epaphroditus has been longing for all of you and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. He was indeed so ill that he nearly died. But God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, because y'all might have blamed me if he had died, and you would have been upset about that, so that I would not have one sorrow after another. Okay. So again, Paul is showing the longing, the concern, the sorrow that he would have had. He's very open about his feelings here. This is what a friend would do. This, a friendship letter is very open about feelings in the ancient world. So this is part of that genre. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, in order that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. About what is Paul worried here? What is he anxious about?
He's worried about their friends.
Yes. He's worried that the Philippians are worried about Epaphroditus because they heard he was ill, they knew that he was dying, and they don't know what's happened to him, and they will feel so much better if they can see him in person on his own two feet. Yeah. Welcome him then in the Lord with all joy and honor such people. Okay. Here's the little plug for itinerancy, right? Honor the people that are coming to you. Why should you honor this one? Because he came close to death for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up for those services that you all could not give me. So Epaphroditus has been representing the Philippians to Paul in Paul's need. The services that you all would have given me if you all could have gotten on the bus and traveled to my jail. So we learn, too, that the role of Epaphroditus and Timothy is not just themselves, but they are representing the community that sends them. In the case of Timothy, he's representing Paul who sends him. So when Timothy gets to the Philippians and he hugs them all, they should feel Paul's embrace. When Epaphroditus gets to Paul, he should feel the Philippians' embrace. Okay? That's the power of the representative. They don't just, or the apostle, right? We know apostles represent Christ. But it works this way too for the messengers. Okay. Now, what else is being shared here?
Joy and honor.
Joy and honor. Good. Okay, freedom from sorrow. Yeah, we're assuaging their sorrow and mine, assuaging your anxiety and mine. Yeah. Notice how Paul is seeking a healthy equilibrium, healthy emotional equilibrium for everybody involved. It's not usually how we think of Paul, but it is here. Let me add a little bit here. Two times, Paul talks about Epaphroditus coming close to death. Right? What are those two phrases? In 27, sorry?
Oh, I was going to say, came close to death, risking his life, and in verse 27 and in 29 or 30.
Good. Close to death, risking his life. Okay. What's that?
For the work of Christ.
For the work of Christ. Now, look at Philippians 2:8. This is the hymn to Christ, known as the hymn to Christ. We don't know, we think it was an original hymn that Paul may have amended. It's talking about Christ. So in 2:8, Christ humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Did anything strike you?
They're sharing the death of Christ.
Who?
Paul, Epaphroditus, and Philippians.
How are they sharing the death of Christ?
By willing to risk the dying, the possibility, the imprisonment. However, the back and forth, the service to Paul and Epaphroditus to them.
Good. So Epaphroditus and Paul through his imprisonment, and Epaphroditus through his risking in this travel. Good.
Also,
now, go ahead.
He also humbled himself and was obedient, even to the risk of death.
Yes.
Which in those days, travel often did that.
Yes. And humbling yourself is sort of like putting other people first. Right? Right? Not doing it, I want to be careful with how we talk about humility here because it's been used against people in a lot of ways. But we'll flesh that out some more.
Could you say that Paul is sharing the whole Judaic promises with people when he emphasizes even death on a cross, which, according to you yesterday, was what hung him up and made him persecute the early church? Is that from Deuteronomy? Says someone who's hung on a tree is cursed.
Right.
So he underlines not just death, but even death
yes,
on the cross.
He does underline that.
So, the whole promises of God to his people, God's people,
are thereby extended to the Philippians who were not Jews.
I think you can see all of that. Let me give you this one phrase that Paul is using, because I think Paul is focused on the very specific parallel between Epaphroditus and Christ. But I think we can certainly read that way too. So in the hymn, in verse 8, Christ humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, mekri thanatu, until death. Okay, mekri thanatu, until death in the Greek. Now, those two words is what Paul uses to talk about Epaphroditus. He doesn't use those two words anywhere else. He is specifically quoting himself or quoting the hymn to interpret what Epaphroditus is doing in the community. Okay? So if we look, not in verse 27, he sets them up in verse 27. He says, indeed, so ill that he nearly died. Okay? But then in 30, he came mekri thanatu, close to death, until death. Okay? So what's the difference between Christ and Epaphroditus? Well, Epaphroditus didn't die. He wasn't charged. He wasn't on a cross, blah, 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 blah. He recovered. Okay. But the mekri thanatu, until death, right, is what Epaphroditus and Christ have in common. And by your extension, Paul in prison. And Paul in... actually, chapters 1 and 3, we'll talk about, I think I'm going to die, I might die, I might not die, it doesn't matter if I die. So he's sort of, in his rhetoric, drawing near to death, entertaining that idea. Yeah, Joe.
Julia, when it says here in chapter 2, obedient to death,
yes,
that suggests to me, you know, kind of the thinking behind atonement theology as compared to engaging the powers. Am I right about that?
What do you mean by engaging the powers?
You know, the theology that Walter Wing is developing,
yeah,
in terms of not so much that Christ was being obedient,
overcoming
to his
evil,
Father to save our sins, but rather Christ was showing us how to live and to engage with the powers and to stand up for justice. So when it says,
yes,
obedient to death, to the point of death, that infers obedience to God.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
And so that would be more consistent with atonement theology.
It would be. Yeah. Yeah, it would be. I think for Paul, Christ is a model of faithfulness and obedience to God. That same faithfulness and obedience that people gave to Torah, or to God through Torah, is what Paul understands about Jesus. And since Jesus was cursed by Torah, well, then which obedience should you follow? Right. Well, the obedience that will bring you to be cursed even though you are being faithful is what you would follow.
Is it possible then that the they that's being talked about are those who are unwilling to be obedient unto death or unwilling to suffer? Or unwilling,
yeah,
to give up, because it would seem that the counterpart of one's willingness to suffer or to die, the opposite of that is self-interest,
yes,
and refusal to help. So
the day
is in that category. I mean, that's,
yes,
kind of an identification of those.
Exactly, folks. Exactly. And I think, at least in Philippians, we don't have a single enemy that he's really pointing to. We have sort of this straw construction of don't do this. And here's the Christ-like construction, and here's the what you should not do. Yeah. So, exactly. The obedience to God is not self-interest. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can talk about self-interest in a whole lot of different ways and,
yes,
and think about, well, what is it that I want for myself? You know, I may have a nice retirement plan or whatever. But this seems to be more specifically tied to the whole question of giving up one's life for the other, or willingness to die, or the obedience in suffering.
Yes. And Paul will further bring this together and say, you know what? I have two good choices. I can die and be with Christ, or I can live and serve the word on earth. Those are both really good choices for me. Either one of them will make me very happy, and I totally applaud them both. And then he asked the question, but what is better for you Philippians? So his choice is not between what's really good for everybody else and what's really bad for me. Or, you know, he's not choosing anything bad for himself. He says, I have two equal things, and my criterion for decision is what is best for Philippians, what is best for the other. And that's the one he chooses. To be alive and remain and minister with you all is the better choice for you. So he chooses not to die. Yes?
Well, I have a sense and that this is the Philippians are kind of like a normal congregation. Part of them are okay about sending Epaphroditus, and some of them are not. And that's what's causing Paul to be anxious. He's trying to address those who are not in favor of this project of helping.
I don't see that. But other scholars have wrestled with exactly the point you're talking about, which is, why is Paul so anxious about Epaphroditus falling ill and sending him back to the Philippians? And what is going on there exactly? There doesn't seem to be any antagonism towards Paul or lack of support from the community, as there is in Corinthians. You can see that there are different factions. This seems to be the least fractious. I mean, he just says, okay, there's two women that aren't getting along. Let's help them get along, everybody. I mean, that's the extent to which he goes to solving problems that way. But that question that you're wrestling with is one that others have really wrestled with. Yeah. What's going on there? We are at 10 o'clock, so I must release you for happy espresso and lattes. Let me see if I can give you one way to wrap all of this up, because I had a little bit more to look at. What I hope you begin to see is the way that Paul is interpreting what's being shared. And the way that Paul is interpreting what's being shared is going to link back to how he wants the community to live. And it's going to teach them how to live as Christ lived. Okay, so the example of Epaphroditus going until death is an example of being like Christ. And that's what they should aim at. And when they aim at being like Christ, and they send a representative to Paul, or Paul sends a representative to them, what are they sharing? Christ. You see? So when you have this exchange, when you have this sharing of all of these things, and this co-working and partnership, and what everybody's striving to do is to embody Christ, then really what you have is when you welcome me, you welcome Christ. And when I receive you in my hospitality, I'm receiving Christ. And we become Christ for one another. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Have a good day, everybody.